Welcome to tonight's class. I'm really glad you can join me, whether you are listening live or you are going to be listening over MP3. So we're covering general nutrition and weight loss tonight. And even if you're not interested in weight loss per se, if you feel like you're at a healthy body weight, I think the discussion is going to be interesting and germane for you, because we're going to sort of track how fat moves through the body. And it's a fun discussion, and it kind of helps you understand how the body works, and it helps appreciate what's really going on in there. And then we'll transition from that to talking more specifically about some of the nutrition principles that we mentioned in the previous class. And we'll wrap up with some really practical stuff, talking about, you know, ordering at restaurants. And then in the follow-up materials, you will get plenty of recipes and actually some notes on a cooking system that I am putting together that I hope you will all really enjoy and succeed with magnificently. So let us start off with how fat gets burned. And I think this is a really interesting topic, because most of us are at least a little bit concerned with our body weight. And even if you're not concerned with body weight, you know, as we age, it's a consideration for about 80% of the population. And the standard mentality in the nutrition and fitness world is that weight loss has to come from a simple equation: calories in and calories out. So in most people's minds, the idea, if you want to lose weight, is that you have to reduce the number of calories that you're taking in and increase the number of calories that you're burning. And if you talk to all sorts of scientists, they'll say that has to be true. It's a law of physics. It's called a law of thermodynamics. And that the only way to do it is to eat fewer calories and do more exercise and burn more calories. So that's the standard mentality. I would call that the central dogma of the fitness world. Calories in minus calories out. And you want to create a caloric deficit, meaning that you want to burn more calories than you take in, and that's how you'll lose weight. And most of what we try to engineer in gyms and in programs, like what the NFL is doing, and in, you know, pretty much almost every effort out there directed towards weight loss, this equation plays a pretty big part. I think it's a very limited way to think. On the surface, it has to be true. If fat is just stored calories, and if you don't burn more calories than you're consuming, of course you're going to continue to store more calories, and it's impossible to reduce body fat stores. But the reason I really don't like this equation is it glosses over what is a much, much more complex process with lots of different players involved. One of the things it doesn't take into account is how much you eat affects your metabolism. So when you change your diet, the amount of calories you burn changes. Also, your exercise patterns affect your appetite. But at a deeper level, the game of weight loss is really about biochemistry. It's about hormones and organ function and glandular function. And as we trace the journey of a fat cell tonight, I think you'll begin to develop a sense of why so many people find weight loss so frustrating. So let's start with where fat lives. Fat lives in between your muscles, and it lives in what's called subcutaneous fat, which is the fat beneath the skin that most of us want to get rid of. And fat lives inside of cells called adipocytes. That's another name for a fat cell. And the job of an adipocyte is to hold on to fat, presumably for a time when you need that fat as a calorie reserve. And a lot of evolutionary biologists think that our ancestors experienced a great deal of famine. So if you think back, you know, 5, 10, 12,000 years ago, if the hunt didn't go well, you were hungry. Or if, you know, the crops went down, there was no food. There were no supermarkets or anything like that. So our bodies developed this capacity to store calories as fat and to want to hold on to those calories. And this is called the thrifty gene hypothesis. It's this big idea that, like, people have these genes that basically tell their fat cells to be thrifty and hold on to the fat that's stored inside of them. Well, as far as it goes, there's really something to this. To get fat out of a fat cell, you actually need some biochemical things to take place. So it's not just like you jump on a treadmill and you're going to start mobilizing fat. You have to get it out of your fat cells. And there's actually a lock on top of fat cells. It's really interesting. So adipocytes hold fat. There's a little lock on top. It's called perilipin. It's a molecule. You don't need to remember the name. And the thing with perilipin is that when perilipin is in place, it's virtually impossible to extract fat from a fat cell and put it into the bloodstream. Well, interestingly, there is a key for the lock, perilipin, and that key is adrenaline. Good old adrenaline. So, you know, adrenaline is what revs you up. It's like what what things like Red Bull mimic, and coffee sort of artificially mimics adrenaline and stimulates some adrenal secretion. Adrenaline is what gets you on the go. It's part of your fight or flight response. So when you get really excited, that's adrenaline. Or if you're in sports and you kind of see the goal ahead of you and you get a surge of energy, that's adrenaline. Well, adrenaline is the key in the lock of the molecule perilipin. So when adrenaline is released by your adrenal glands, circulates through your bloodstream, and it goes to your fat cells, and it literally talks to your fat cells and says, open up, guys, mobilize body fat out into the bloodstream. and then body fat moves out into the bloodstream. The rate at which fat is extracted from fat cells after adrenaline interacts with perilipin increases 50-fold. 50-fold. So you get 50 times as much fat out of your fat cells into your bloodstream when you have adrenaline flowing through your system. Many, many people experience something called adrenal fatigue. It's not a medically diagnosed condition. There are medical forms of it, but it's a very, very common condition in our society where the adrenal glands just don't kind of work as well as they should. And some of the symptoms of adrenal fatigue are low energy levels, difficulty rising, especially in the morning, difficulty kind of getting up for life and getting up for exercise, and actually sometimes difficulty sleeping at night. And a lot of people find they kind of have this, you know, I'm tired all the time thing and they can't lose weight, and there's a connection. It's because the adrenal glands aren't really functioning up to par. So if we go back to our calories in versus calories out equation, the average person who's struggling to lose weight is going to read a magazine or they're going to go to a gym, and someone's going to talk to them about, you know, you got to eat fewer calories and you got to exercise more, and they're going to do that. But the problem is, without adrenaline flowing through their system, virtually impossible to get fat out of their fat cells into the bloodstream. So it's virtually impossible to lose weight. And also, interestingly, it's harder to exercise because adrenaline actually helps you exercise. So all of a sudden, we've got one player, the adrenal glands, and their ability to produce adrenaline. And if you don't consider it, it kind of throws that whole equation out the window. Well, so far, we've only looked at the first step, taking fat out of a fat cell and putting it in the bloodstream. Fat in the bloodstream doesn't really do much. Fat doesn't kind of circulate around to your cells and get used for energy. It's not really how it works. Fats have to be converted into sugars to get used for energy. And the place that happens is in your liver. So when fat is extracted from a fat cell, circulates through the body, ends up in the liver is going to take that fat and it's going to break it down and actually use it to create sugars. Sugars are kind of the energy currency of life. And if all goes well, you are regularly accessing body fat, taking it out of your fat cells, taking it to your liver, turning it into sugar, and then that sugar circulates around through your bloodstream and gets used by your heart and your brain and your muscles and all sorts of other tissues. Well, again, interestingly, if the liver isn't working right, this is like another knot hole. It's another barrier to the burning of fat because you can't use circulating fat for energy unless the liver is functioning well. And actually, when you start to get a lot of fat circulating around that's not being used, right, this is actually really bad for you. It's bad for your arterial health. So when the liver is dysfunctional, when it's toxic, it's another barrier to fat burning. And this is an incredibly common condition in our culture. The liver is not only the place where you turn fat into sugar, it's also the place where you make a lot of your body's chemistry. And critically, it is the detox center for the human body. So the liver has the job of taking all the chemicals in the body that could damage the body and breaking them down into safe forms so that they can be excreted. Well, as you take more and more toxic chemicals into your body, you actually begin to damage your liver cells, and liver health can decline. And as liver health declines, the efficiency of the liver in processing fats into sugars, of course, declines. So as a result, you've now got another barrier. And the body's really smart. If you're mobilizing fat out of your fat cells, even if you have a bit of adrenaline, and if it's circulating through your bloodstream but your liver isn't using it for energy, there's a feedback loop. Your body actually then knows to not take the fat out of the fat cells, so the fat stays in the fat cells. So now let's assume that your adrenal glands are okay and your liver is okay. So you can get fat out of your fat cells, circulate it through your bloodstream, get it to your liver, process it in the liver into sugars, and those sugars go back out into your bloodstream. Well, to now get used efficiently for energy, those sugars actually have to get into your muscle cells. And this requires the action of insulin in a coordinated fashion. So insulin is made by the pancreas, and a lot of people have imbalances in the secretion of insulin as well. And so here's another biochemical barrier. And I don't want to labor this story too much. I just wanted to talk about this to illustrate the fact that in the process of burning fat, there's a whole lot of steps along the way. And the sort of hit the gym hard and eat better mentality, it's not smart wellness. And I think it leads to a lot of frustration because I think a lot of very well-intentioned people really do endeavor to change their bodies and they're willing to commit to a certain amount of effort when if all these systems are working right, weight loss doesn't have to be all that effortful. You can do a relatively minimal amount of targeted and effective exercise, and then most people can succeed. Now, what if these systems aren't working right? It's a little bit beyond the scope of this course to talk about spot fixing defects in the adrenal glands or in the liver or in the thyroid gland is another big one. If your thyroid doesn't work right, your cellular metabolism is too low, and then it's going to be impossible to burn fat. And there's more. There's glands in the brain that get involved in this. But the wonderful thing is to sort of return to the central theme of class one, is that the human body is built to work pretty well as long as we live the way that we're designed to live. So living the way we were designed to live, we talked about exercise and we talked about core nutrition. And what I want to do now to transition is to look a little bit at how certain core nutritional errors actually run down these glandular and organ systems that are so necessary for burning fat. So we're gonna beat up on sugar and white flour in this course. They really are metabolic toxins. And one of the reasons that sugar and white flour are so incredibly toxic is that they sabotage the adrenal glands. So when you eat a high volume of sugar or flour in the form of a lot of white bread or pasta, the adrenals actually have to work very hard to stabilize the massive surge in blood sugar and the crash that follows. And it tends to lead to the release of cortisol, which is a fat storage hormone. In addition, the pancreas has to work very hard. So type 2 diabetes is, in essence, a disease where your cells stop listening to your pancreas precisely because you're eating too much sugar and too many carbohydrates. And even if you don't have type 2 diabetes, there's still a good chance that if you're eating a lot of sugar and a lot of white flour, you're short-circuiting one of those critical biochemical mechanisms which is necessary for fat to get burned. So there are a lot of other mistakes that people make. If you eat a lot of toxic food, you're actually going to really damage your liver. So if you eat a lot of preservatives, which are, you know, many times in processed foods, if you're eating a lot of microwave meals, especially frozen meals, things like that, things that, you know, sit on store shelves for a long time, it's not just the calories in that stuff that contributes to weight gain over time, but there are actual direct effects that the preservatives, the toxic chemicals inside of these foods have on liver health. Sorry, excuse me. So all in all, the whole foods diet is really, really critical for weight loss. It is a weight loss diet. That said, its intention isn't weight loss, and this is really, really important for this course. So I actually changed the title of this course later on to Breakthrough Results from Weight Loss to Wellness, and I didn't just mean getting breakthrough results in the spheres of weight loss and wellness. I meant also transitioning from a weight loss mentality into a wellness mentality. And what is a wellness mentality? It's thinking that if I live the way that I'm kind of designed to live, my body will thrive. And I'm going to focus on thriving and feeling good and not worry about the weight loss. And then I trust that in time the weight loss will follow. And that's really what I want to be the theme of tonight's class. Healthy weight loss happens gradually, and it happens as a consequence of building a firm foundation of health in the body. So the average person struggling to lose weight, adrenal glands aren't working great, liver's not working great, thyroid's not working great, a lot of other stuff going on. The absolute first step is to stop consuming the foods that are deteriorating the biochemical systems and the organ systems that are so critical in burning fat. And then, of course, you also have to eat foods that nourish those systems. And, of course, as it turns out, all of our organs and all of our glands are built to work pretty well when we eat the right stuff. So with spot repair, if you, you know, think that you have adrenal dysfunction or thyroid dysfunction, one, we can certainly talk about that in person. You can always give me a call or email me. And we're going to do a little bit of that stuff in Class 7, which is on detox and GI health. But for the most part, given time and space, the body is reasonably good at self-correction as long as we do everything right. And we're going to start with nutrition, and then we're going to fold in exercise, and we're going to fold in the mind-body practices. And if you kind of bring all that stuff in line, mostly the body sorts itself out and takes care of itself. So I wanted to share that by way of introduction to sort of frame our discussion of healthy eating tonight. And we're going to move more deeply into the distinction whole foods tonight and what eating whole foods really looks like in actual practice. So whole foods, again, you know, they're intact foods. They're foods that you can find out in nature. And in terms of what to eat for breakfast, lunch, dinner, I'll send you guys recipes and I'll send you out a bunch of stuff. But for tonight, what I really want to get into is the sort of more real-life decisions around where breakdowns occur. Because if you can make time to cook at home, and I really recommend it, and you can follow the system that I'm going to be sending out, and we'll talk about it at the end, you're going to take care of yourself. But where people break down is like eating at work, when they have to go out to restaurants, dinner parties, those kinds of situations. These tend to be trouble, and you may have also noticed in your life that if you're being really good and you go to one of these situations and you deviate, kind of, you know, then the brain starts justifying what you did and everything kind of tumbles down from there. So I wanted to triage with you the most important stuff to avoid in common trouble eating situations inside the rubric of eating a whole foods diet. The biggest thing you want to avoid doing is eating a processed carbohydrate on an empty stomach. So you never want to show up somewhere and eat bread. The reason is that it's going to trigger your appetite. It's actually going to make you much hungrier. The same thing would apply to like snack chips or something of that nature. You always want fiber, protein, and fat as soon as you show up anywhere. So if you're at a party, hummus and vegetable dippers is one of the absolute best things that you can consume. When you go out to restaurants, take a pass on the bread. If you can eat olives, olives are really great. They're full of fat, in a very healthy fat, and they will really help sate your hunger sort of before it kicks in. When it comes to ordering meals, you know, look around for bean-vegetable combinations, meat-vegetable combinations, fish-vegetable combinations. This stuff's pretty straightforward. And when you're on the go and in places like at work, Chipotle is a really good option. Baja Fresh is a really good option. The Mexican restaurants are fantastic because you can get basically just bowls of beans and vegetables, so it's really easy to do whole foods. You really want to avoid sandwiches. Most sandwich places have salads at this point. It is so worth it. And the key to making this work is if you feel kind of like, meh, about your salad for lunch and you really want a sandwich, find a better way to treat yourself. You'd actually be, in my book, much better off eating the salad and then having like a bit of chocolate afterwards or something like that than you would be eating the sandwich. You know, cutting the bread out of your life is going to be really, really critical. So those are just some simple tips on sort of triaging whole foods. And I wanted to throw that out there right off the bat because I know that that's the stuff that kind of worries people. And now we're going to dive into really eating inside of this framework of what I like to call a diet of abundance. So this is sort of like stop the conversation we're having, start new conversations. So we talked a little bit about weight loss and we talked a little bit about troubleshooting. Now we're going to talk about this idea of diet of abundance. What the diet of abundance concept is it really is a way of thinking about food. That's going to be our big focus for tonight and with the materials I'm going to be sending all of you over the next couple of days. And we live in a sort of restriction, deprivation culture around food. We sort of look at the stuff we want like it's sinful, and then we look at all the stuff that's good for us like it's awful. And then there's this tension between healthy and fun. And most people, when they think about nutrition, when they think about dieting, really the background, like the way that it occurs in the back of your mind is like sacrifice. I got to give up stuff that I like in order to get to some goal that I guess I have to get to because we live in a culture that's obsessed with this stuff. I think it's a very damaging way to think. I think it contributes to a lot of self-esteem problems in our culture. You know, we see eating disorders are just at, you know, epic rates. And I think there are lots and lots of people who kind of have low-grade eating disorders that don't get diagnosed clinically because we're just so obsessed with weight loss and with being thin. So the diet of abundance concept takes that word diet and it switches it around to be proactive, making your life the way that you want it to be. The idea is don't ever, and I really can't stress this enough, don't ever think about what you're not supposed to eat. It's a dangerous path to walk down. Instead, think about how you fill your life with all of the healthy, nourishing, delicious food possible and get creative about it. Really get creative about it. So think to yourself, you know, okay, well, what can I make that's really great that I can store for 3 nights in the freezer and have enough for, you know, extra servings and take into lunch day after day after day? Or can I explore around here and, you know, find a healthy place to go? And can I also find some healthy treats near my work? Can I find a great salad place and a great fish place and a great Mexican place? And then maybe find a smoothie bar and, you know, occasionally I'll treat myself to a fruit smoothie or something like that. It's really getting proactive about rewarding yourself and enjoying your food and nourishing yourself in a way that ultimately works for your body. One of my catchphrases around diet of abundance is you don't eat to live and you don't live to eat. You eat to live as well as possible. And it's a very simple thought. Eat to live as well as possible. So the idea is that food should serve your total well-being and happiness. It's not about weight loss. It's about total well-being and happiness. And that includes everything. It includes the way your food tastes. It includes the visual presentation. It includes, you know, an adequate amount of variety, and it also includes the social component when you're going to be, you know, meeting people and sharing food and stuff like that. So inside of the diet of abundance mentality, the thing I'm going to be emailing out to all you guys is basically a system that I'm really excited to talk about where you cook a limited number of starting ingredients each week, and then you combine those starting ingredients in different ways to create a good variety of tasty dishes. So here's an example. Let's say Sunday, you want to take 3-4 hours and sort out your food basically for the whole week. You make a pot of black beans, a pot of chickpeas, a pot of brown rice, and a pot of quinoa. And you maybe stir fry some chicken, and you cut up a whole bunch of vegetables, and you make 2 yummy salad dressings. And all of this you make in, you know, 3 or 4 servings. Well, now you've got 12 to 15 potential meals. And the interesting thing is that you can swap and mix and match ingredients in lots and lots of different ways. And those are going to be the recipes that I'm going to be sending out. So you can take different cut vegetables and mix them with different spices and maybe a different oil and mix chicken in sometimes and not other times and provide beans. And you can really create a wonderful diversity of healthy stuff. And I can't recommend this enough. I mean, I know that for most people, the application of this course is going to come more in like restaurant selections and grocery store stuff. But if you can take it on to do this, it makes a really profound difference. It'll help you put this diet of abundance concept into place in your life. So you literally put this in your planner, put it in your schedule. Just try it this week. Carve out 4 hours to make food. Just carve it out. Think about all of the headache that it will save you and also all the money that it will save you. It's really, really worth it because there's nothing cheaper than organic beans and organic grains. And if you cut up a bunch of vegetables and stuff and you don't eat out, it'll really save you a bunch of money. And take the recipes that I'll be sending out and work on, you know, combine two or three different interesting things this week and take them into work with you and eat them at home. And it'll start you down this path of eating inside of a whole foods mentality from the perspective of diet of abundance in a way that's really easy and really actionable right now. And if you can combine that with just the simple tips about, you know, being at the office, being at parties, going to restaurants, don't ever eat bread on an empty stomach. Don't ever eat sugars on an empty stomach. And also try to avoid things like snack chips because they're going to make you really, really hungry. You're going to be out there ahead of the game. So that is a pretty simple formula for general nutrition. General nutrition is really only about understanding that, okay, there's this whole foods thing, then understanding I need to not think in terms of deprivation. I need to eat about 80%, 90% whole foods and not think about deprivation. And then you just kind of put a system in place in your life that makes eating an abundant whole foods diet really easy for you. Nutrition is almost honestly that simple. You know, we're going to get into individualizing nutrition, and it is true that there are individual differences, and we're going to explore those. And they are icing on the cake. They're not unimportant icing, but they are icing on the cake. This is the cake. The simplicity of it is its entire charm. So for tonight's class, I really want to talk with you guys about food, and I'm also happy to present more content. I will pause now and take any questions that those of you who are on live might have, and you can also direct the rest of the discussion. And if you don't have any questions and you run out of stuff, I'll just move on with the content that I've got. Okay? Any questions?
The olives. You mean black and green or either one?
Yeah, but both olives are fantastic for you, and it's good to mix up what you eat as much as possible. But both black and green olives are really, really helpful.
Okay, so it doesn't matter which one.
No.
When you say one more question. When you say snack chips, do you include pretzels in them?
Yes, definitely pretzels. So anything that's a processed, flour-based snack food. If you really like snack chips, there are some new products out now that are much more healthful. There's something called Snap Pea Crisps that you can find at Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. They're not expensive. They're about $1.40 a bag. And they're really not bad. They're actual snap peas with a little bit of corn flour. And they're cooked in, or rice flour, and they're cooked in oil. And they're not so bad. You know, they're closer to a whole food. I would call them like maybe, you know, a not so unhealthy treat. There are also brown rice chips, and the body tends to handle those a little bit better. There's a company called Lundberg that makes a variety of flavors of brown rice chips, and those are a little more healthful too. So if you're a big chip person, the idea is no deprivation here. You know, you want to follow the 80-20 principle, maybe the 90-10 principle. If you're going to treat yourself, you know, just try to make those kinds of choices. The biggest thing to avoid is wheat. And if you're ever curious, look on the back. And if you see enriched flour on the back of anything, that's the stuff to stay away from, except on, you know, birthdays and Christmas and stuff like that. Other questions?
I found a potato chip.
Okay.
My daughter likes chips with her lunch. And it has just potatoes, safflower oil, I think, something else, salt. There's only like 4 ingredients. And it has 7 grams of monounsaturated fat. But is that healthy or not?
Well, it's interesting. So it's interesting that it has monounsaturated fat because safflower oil is not a monounsaturated fat.
I can't remember. It might be sunflower oil or some kind of oil.
Maybe. You know, potatoes are pretty high glycemic, meaning they tend to cause a pretty good blood sugar spike. And spiking blood sugar really messes with people. You know, it messes with brain chemistry. It changes appetite. It's a question of volume always. I mean, you don't want to say to a kid, you can't have anything delicious, right? It's a disaster. They're going to go eat that stuff when you're not around, and they're going to feel awful about it. But it isn't something you'd want to feed her loads of. It's also much better, interestingly, for her and for adults, to eat potato chips after a meal as opposed to before. And the reason for that is, imagine you have an empty stomach right now, and you take some potato chips and you eat them. What's going to happen is those chips are going to go down into your stomach, and your stomach acids are going to really quickly break them down because there's not much to them. They're so processed. You know, there's not a lot of integrity to the food. So it moves very quickly into your gut, and then the carbohydrates in those chips just surge into your bloodstream, and your blood sugar shoots way up, and then, you know, your pancreas and your adrenal glands and everything has to compensate. But imagine instead that you had some chicken and a salad with olive oil and some nuts before your potato chips. Well, now you've eaten that stuff, so you've actually got the fiber and the protein and the fat in your belly. And when you eat the chips, they're literally going to go down and they're going to sit on top of that. As your stomach moves, they're going to mix up with that stuff. And then it's going to take a little time for the stomach to say, okay, you know, all this different food is ready to go to the small intestine, so it's going to slow down the digestion. Well, interestingly, in the small intestine, now the body isn't just getting the carbohydrates and the potato chips. It's also getting protein, and protein helps stabilize blood sugar. So it's much, much better to eat that kind of stuff when you're already full of healthy food. And maybe that's even a system that she would like. I mean, I would hesitate about making the chips like a reward for her finishing, you know, vegetables and chicken. You know, kids are starting to think vegetables and chicken are punishment, and their potato chips are their reward. But if there's an easy way to get her to eat them after a meal, it's much, much better. Another thing, too, interestingly, is hydration. You want to be very well hydrated before you snack on anything because the brain confuses dehydration and hunger. So if you start snacking while dehydrated, there's a much greater chance that you're going to get a real powerful surge in appetite. Just a couple thoughts. Any other questions? Okay. Well, let me then finish up for tonight's class by actually jumping ahead a little bit in our schedule. I actually got through this content much, much, much faster than I expected to. So we're going to pop ahead a little bit, and we will just adjust our schedule accordingly. So we're talking nutrition, and there's a really interesting way to begin to understand both nutrition and exercise from a new perspective. We talked about the biochemistry of how fat gets burned, and this idea that stuff, you know, needs to get moved around and that certain chemicals have to be released and that it's really more complex than a simple calories in versus calories out equation. The one thing that I haven't mentioned in all of this is the role of genes, the role of good old DNA. So genes are a fascinating topic in our culture. Everyone has heard of genes. It's such a common concept, and that's kind of amazing because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, only scientists talked about genes. And 50 years ago, the structure of DNA was discovered. So this idea of genes has kind of, you know, it's taken us by storm. And everywhere in the popular media, you always see articles featuring stuff with genetics. And there is almost no one you could meet where if you said, do you know what it means for something to be genetic, they wouldn't say, absolutely, I know what it means if something's genetic. It means you inherited it, and that's like the way it is. And that's really where most people's understanding of genetics is. If you have a certain gene, that's just the way it is. So I think the way that we look at this in our culture is we sort of say to ourselves, you know, I've got my good genes and I got my bad genes. And I look at my mom and dad and I think maybe I got some bad genes from them. So maybe I need to do some stuff to kind of hedge against the negative effects of those bad genes. And I hope I don't have some really bad genes that give me something awful later in life. I'm probably not going to think about that. I'm going to go into denial. And the reason is that we think about genes as kind of like blueprints, kind of like these fixed phenomena that spell out the way that we as human beings are structured. This is actually not at all the way that genes work, and no one in the cutting edge of science looks at genetics this way. But it's an old idea that's kind of stuck around in our popular culture, and it's something that most people still believe. So when I talk tonight about when you start exercising, you actually need to mobilize adrenaline from your adrenal glands. Adrenaline is made by genes. You actually can't make any chemical in the body without genes, and this is pretty much what genes do. They actually encode the information that spells out the chemicals and the molecules that make us. So you have genes that make proteins that build muscle, and you have genes that make the stuff that builds bone, and you have genes that make adrenaline and growth hormone and, you know, the stuff that makes your eyes and everything. You have genes that program how your hair is going to grow. And fascinatingly, your genome, which is the collection of all your genes, it really does contain all of the instructions for building you. But critically, it's not like you inherit that set of instructions and then you just end up the way that it's spelled out. Because the thing about genes is they turn on and off. And this is still new language to many people, that genes turn on and off, but they do. And in fact, they turn on and off all the time. So in the case of adrenaline, you have a gene that makes adrenaline. Well, that gene isn't on all the time. Sometimes it turns on. And when it's turned on, it makes adrenaline. And when it's turned off, it doesn't make adrenaline. And over the course of a day, your adrenal genes turn on and they turn off, and they turn on and they turn off. And there are rhythms to these things. The part that I think is so cool and so underappreciated is that the rhythms with which genes turn on and off actually influence the entire biochemical composition of our body, and it responds to the way that we live our lives. So the way you live turns genes on and off, which literally coordinates the cellular and biochemical and physiological symphony that is you, that is your physical body. It's not like we talked in the first class about every part of you is always turning over. You know, you're always getting new skin and new bones and new liver. That's because genes are turning on and off. And something as simple as getting up in the morning and going for a 15-minute brisk walk turns on hundreds, if not thousands, of genes. Hundreds, if not thousands. Getting sunlight in your eyes in the early morning actually turns on genes. Deep breathing can turn on genes. Absolutely astonishing. And this is the part that's really out there for many people, but psychological states affect gene expression. Astonishing, right? That psychological states affect gene expression. But no one can really argue with this anymore. I mean, this is established, firmly researched scientific fact. So literally, if you are in a chronic state of stress, the genetic rhythms in your body are altered, and therefore your biochemistry is altered, and therefore your physiology is altered. So it's not just movement. It's everything we've talked about. You know, we mentioned that our theme is like meds, mindset, exercise, diet, sleep. All of those elements affect genetic rhythms. And this is an interesting way to start thinking about how your body works. So for fat to get burned, or for anything that you want to happen with your body to happen, what has to happen is all of the right chemistry has got to line up. You've got to, you know, make adrenaline and make insulin the right way from your pancreas and run your liver right to burn fat. If you want to build muscle, there's actually a bunch of genes that affect muscle building, like human growth hormone. There's a big one called mTOR that gets studied a lot. And when these genes turn on, they make the proteins that build muscle. When they don't turn on, they don't. So I love to ask people the question, how does exercise really work? You go to the gym, you lift some weights for a while, and your muscle gets bigger. Well, how did that happen? You had to actually make new muscle protein. And new muscle proteins are made by genes. So your action of doing a biceps curl must have actually stimulated genes in a way where they made more protein. Absolutely astonishing. Well, at the end of the day, we human beings have around 25 to 30,000 active genes. It's not really not that big a number, just 25 to 30,000. And those 25 to 30,000 active genes actually spell out the instructions for literally everything in us, everything in us. And when you do something as simple as 20 minutes of exercise, you change the turn-on, turn-off pattern of somewhere between 800 and 1,000 genes, possibly more. Amazing. I mean, a huge percentage of your genome. So here's the next thought that I really like to put out there for people. Throughout all of human history, our ancestors were exercising in consistent rhythms. Doesn't that mean that our DNA is only built to work right given that stimulus? I mean, think about it like this, right? Genes turn on and off, and our bodies are pretty well adapted to living and being healthy and thriving. And we know that because hunter-gatherers are so healthy. Well, if genes turn on and off, and they actually respond to the way you live to tell them when to turn on and off, it actually implies that our genes were designed to work right only if you live right. And I think that is a powerful, powerful perspective, that from the DNA up, our bodies are built to work as they're designed to work, given the conditions and the lifestyle that existed during the time when we were being formulated. So how does this all apply? We're going to talk in depth about exercise in the next class. We're going to talk about actually how to exercise. In fact, that's all the next class is about. Today's class is about nutrition, and I only wanted to talk about exercise briefly, one, to introduce the concept, but then also because I think it's a little easier to see this from the perspective of exercise, to actually get this connection. Okay, I sort of get it. Like if I do some biceps curls, how does my muscle get bigger? Well, for the muscle to get bigger, I must make new muscle. Only thing that makes anything in the body is a gene. The genes clearly weren't making new muscle when I wasn't exercising. So if I started doing the curls, must be turning the genes on and making new muscle. This actually applies to nutrition too. there's something called nutrigenomics, which is the science of how food interacts with DNA. And sure enough, it turns out that the foods that we eat really alter the way that our DNA works. It's almost amazing. It's almost like chilling when you start to think about it. And vegetables especially have been studied extensively in connection with this. There's a lot of belief in the scientific community that eating a consistent diet of vegetables is actually critical for what's called your tumor suppressor genes to work right. You actually have genes that function to suppress tumors, which means kill off cancers before they really emerge and become a problem. And it looks like those genes don't work right without vegetables. And this is actually why we have the five-a-day vegetable campaign. So I believe it was started by the American Cancer Society because there was this demonstrated link. So I don't want to beat the horse to death, but there's such an incredibly profound and moving case from my perspective for this central theme of our course. And once you sort of understand, my God, the DNA up, every part of me, it turns on, turns off. There is no fixed program to who I am. It's more flexible than that. And the way that my DNA is going to build my body is a consequence of how I live my life. Now, I definitely want to take some questions on this. Before we get into that, there are inherent genetic differences. So some people are certainly born with, you could call it a genetic advantage, but at the end of the day, you know, we're all just different. I mean, I'm never going to be LeBron James. You know, some people are just born with phenomenal genes that allow them to become great athletes. And similarly, some people are born with an easier time burning fat or building muscle or other phenomena like that. But that said, everyone actually has tremendous flexibility, tremendous genetic flexibility. And for most of the conditions that most of us are dealing with, there is the inherent flexibility in our genomes to kind of liberate us from where we think our limits are. But the critical thing about the way it works is it doesn't play by the rules that we've made up. It plays according to its design. And we have made up an entire culture and an entire civilization and a weight loss industry and a fitness industry and a nutrition industry that pays no attention to any of this stuff. And even less so do our jobs and our, you know, social contacts and anyone else pay any attention to this stuff. So we don't live in a world that says, oh, wait, I have a body and it's only going to thrive when I live, right? We live in a world that, you know, is just concerned with the business of the world. So it's on each of us to kind of get the strength of this connection and begin to really understand that these lifestyle choices, they're about everything, literally everything. I mean, you know, if you're chronically hypoglycemic, you can't function well in relationships. You're going to feel tired and cranky all the time. If you have a lot of inflammation in your gastrointestinal tract, it affects the chemistry of focus in your brain. You're going to have trouble paying attention. You're going to manifest symptoms like ADD. And all that stuff is a consequence of just, you know, eating stuff we're not meant to eat, moving the way we're not meant to move, living the way we're not meant to live, and there's a very strong mind-body connection. So the case for adequate nutrition and the case for adequate exercise and all of that, the science is overwhelming, and we're kind of poised on the edge of what I think is going to be a cultural revolution in understanding all this stuff. But one of my real hopes for this class is that you can kind of get on ahead of the curve, that you really can get the connection, that lifestyle and fitness and nutrition are truly beyond weight loss. It truly is inside this wellness paradigm. And this is what wellness is. Wellness is getting all of your DNA, all of your cells, all of your organs, all of your systems, all functioning at an optimum, which they're essentially mostly pretty much built to do as long as we live the right way. So that was my little tangent for tonight, and it'll save us some time moving into the exercise content tomorrow. Let me pause again and take any questions you guys have. Please, anyone? If not, I had a couple email questions. Oh, please.
I have a question in regards to getting the, you know, five vegetables a day.
Sure.
What are the five that have that you would recommend that are the most beneficial?
Great question. So you actually really want to vary up your vegetable intake. You want to rotate which vegetables you consume. The leafy greens are probably the most nutritious of all vegetables. So spinach and baby lettuces and bib lettuces, not the kind of, you know, whitewashed iceberg lettuces. And actually the more southern greens are wonderful if you like them, collards and turnip greens. Dandelion greens are phenomenal, just an incredible health benefit to the human body. And if you know, a little bitter, you can mix them into your salads. Broccoli and cauliflower are both fantastic and should definitely be rotated in and out. The bell peppers are teeming with antioxidants, the red, yellow, and orange bell peppers. You just don't want to eat them too often. And asparagus is a really great vegetable. pretty much everything that's crunchy is really pretty good for you at the end of the day. Cucumbers have a lot of nutritional value. Zucchini and squash, you're probably going to end up cooking. Variation is the name of the game. And you also, interestingly, want to vary up fresh and frozen vegetables. So many people question, you know, should I buy fresh, should I buy frozen? And what seems to be the case is that freezing preserves some nutrition and kind of lets other nutrition deteriorate, whereas in fresh vegetables, because they spend more time in warehouses unfrozen, other nutrients deteriorate. So it's actually really cool to eat a variety of fresh and frozen veggies. And I think one of the big tips for success with all this stuff is to keep some frozen vegetables that you like that are easy to stir fry or easy to just steam in your freezer. If you have a Trader Joe's near you, they have a really wide variety of things. Like, you know, they have a bell pepper and onion mix. They've got chopped spinach. They've got broccoli and cauliflower. And it's so easy to take that stuff, throw it in a pan with some olive oil, add, you know, chicken or whatever spices you like, maybe a little soy sauce, and it's like, you know, 5-minute meals. Or you can steam it up. So frozen vegetables are great. Fresh vegetables are great. Probably eating about a salad a day, 4 or 5 days a week, is right for us as human beings. And you almost can't go wrong with above-ground vegetables. The only vegetables that are questionable in their nutritional properties are the below-ground vegetables, like parsnips and potatoes and yams. Mostly they're just starch. Turnips are the same, and some of the roots like taro and yucca, some of the less common stuff. And those guys are more like treats. They don't have a whole lot of nutritional value. But everything that grows above ground is awesome, and it's good to vary it up as much as possible. If you really want me to weigh in on the top choices, I would go broccoli, baby lettuce, cooked spinach probably is my top five. Bell peppers and cucumbers would be the ones I would recommend most fervently.
And the peppers, I love red peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Why should you not eat those, like, on a daily basis? Not that
it's
I
interesting.
Do.
So bell peppers actually contain a chemical that inhibits the synthesis of new joint tissue. And so if you eat them too often, people can develop arthritis and joint pain. Now, that said, if you're eating a bell pepper or two a day and you're not getting that, no problem. But if you eat loads of bell peppers and your knees hurt or your knuckles hurt, there might be a connection. So if you're not getting the symptoms, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay. But a couple times a week would be fine.
Oh, yeah, no problem there. Yeah, 3-4 times a week is great. Yeah, it's interesting with vegetables. I mean, overeating anything – oh, cabbage is also fabulous. Overeating anything can actually become damaging. But you kind of have to work to do it. I mean, you'd have to eat like, you know, pound and a half of broccoli a day for broccoli to become damaging to your system. So everything, of course, in reasonable moderation. But you'd have to go pretty crazy to overeat your above-ground veggies. They're all pretty wonderful for the body.
Is there a difference with organic vegetables? If you just wash it off, is there really a big difference?
Yeah, there definitely is a difference with organics. One, there's a good amount of research that shows that organic vegetables actually have higher nutrient density. The FDA poo-poos that, but, you know, the FDA is kind of in the business of promoting big agriculture. So I trust the research that says organic is healthier. The one thing with the pesticides and all the other stuff they grow those with is they all penetrate through the skin of the vegetable. So one of the really great tips is if you don't want to buy all organic, there are certain things that you definitely want to avoid. Blueberries, cherries, nectarines, peaches, celery, lettuce are all very high in pesticides. And let me put that on a note to actually send you guys this list. There's something called the Dirty Dozen. They're the most pesticide-rich vegetables, and they're the ones that are hardest to get the pesticides off of. So if you don't want to be bothered with buying organic everything, you can just kind of buy organic with the dirty guys.
Okay, true.
But I really don't make the difference.
If you eat blueberries, you want to stick to organic blueberries, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. With berries, the thing is, if you're not going to buy organic, soak them. Don't just wash them.
Okay.
So one thing that's easy, you never want to soak them when you want to eat them, because that's annoying. But when you first get them, you can soak them and then put them in a little colander to dry and put them in the fridge, you know, if you can. You can also actually buy really natural vegetable washes. If you go to any health food store, they'll have, usually it's like a vinegar base, and it's something that, you know, you could just drink straight out of the bottle. It's not bad for you. It's completely food. But it's actually designed to peel off food glazes and pesticides and things like that. And I think those are effective as well. You don't want to get too obsessed with this stuff. I think, you know, the way that I do it is I buy most of my produce at Trader Joe's. It's a higher level of quality. And, you know, I just try not to overeat. If I eat blueberries and bell peppers and things like that are high pesticide, I try to only do it occasionally. Okay. Okay, well, let me tackle the two questions that you emailed in, Kimberly, because I think they're really good. One, you asked about whole grain cereals, and usually if something says whole grain, it's bad for you. Whole grain is a misleading name that food manufacturers try to use to foister off low-quality products that aren't really whole grain on the general public. So whole grain isn't something that's enforced. So a whole grain boxed cold cereal is really, really processed. The only thing is they haven't actually thrown out any part of the grain that they started with. So it's still not healthful stuff, like you see, like multi-grain, whole grain, flakes and O's and things like that. They're really not the best. You also had a question about water, which I think is something worth talking about briefly. You know, most of us probably don't drink enough water. 2 to 3 liters a day for an average-sized person, around 170, 180 pounds, is probably about right. You have to drink more if you get more physical activity and if you're bigger. And one thing about water, you asked about Deer Park water. You know, bottled waters are generally higher quality than tap waters. When it comes to spring waters, Voss and Fiji are the absolute top in terms of purity, but there's nothing wrong with Deer Park water. Filters, commercial filters really work pretty well, drinking filtered water. The only thing with your water filters is that they take the ions out of water. So one thing I always recommend to people is like an incredibly tiny little pinch of sea salt stirred into your filtered water will increase the electrolyte content and will actually help your cells absorb it better. So not enough to taste. So if you filter your own water and you want to hydrate more thoroughly, and actually it improves the taste of the water, it makes it taste more smooth in the mouth, you just put a little tiny pinch of sea salt. You know, that said, many people swear by the more expensive and elaborate commercial water filters, and there are some incredibly impressive water filters out there that don't just take the toxins out of water, the heavy metals and things like that, but they really enrich the water. They change its pH and they change its ionization, and many people literally swear by these things. So if you're ultra interested in finding healthier water, shoot me an email, and I will email you back some information on finding super healthy water systems. Any other questions?
So if those pitchers that have the filter and you run
yes.
the water and then it goes through and then you put it in the fridge?
Yes.
Those things. Like maybe 3 little granules of sea salt for the pitcher?
It's tiny. I mean, we're talking almost like what you could get on the tines of a fork. But the thing is, if you taste it, it's too much. So when I say a pinch, it's like what would come between your tips of your fingers and thumb. And if you taste it, it's too much. And then, try again.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure. Well, here's the thing to do in follow-up for tonight, whenever you hear this class. So we really want to put into place a very, very simple, healthy whole foods cooking system. I'm going to email this out. But again, here's the essence of it. Carve out some time. If you can only do an hour or two, great. But if you can take 3 or 4 hours, give this a go. We're going to make up some stir fries. We're going to cook some beans. We're going to cook some grains. And we're not just going to make dishes. We're going to prepare ingredients so that you can make salads. And then if you want to cook, you can make more stir fries. So the idea is to start having a weekly rhythm of having a time set aside to prepare healthy food. This is such a boon. And then you just keep it in Tupperware in the fridge or Purex. Purex actually is wonderful storage containers. Glass is always better than plastic. And that's really the big one to take away from this class, to start putting that into action. I'm also going to send out just some basic tips on navigating restaurants and eating out and parties and things like that. And if you go out, put those into place. And then, as always, email me any questions, and I'm happy to take more questions tonight. And if not, that is a wrap. Okay, great. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to ship this stuff off to you probably on Friday. We'll get this class posted, and I will email out the PDFs of this system, and then hopefully you can put it into place this weekend, and I will look forward to joining you next week.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Yep. Good night, everybody. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
All the best. Bye-bye.